this is Christopher Long, and you're listening to The Digital Dialogue, a podcast dedicated to cultivating the excellences of dialogue in a digital age. This is episode 45, and today I'm joined by Josh Hayes, who is currently a lecturer at Santa Clara University. He's also been a visiting assistant professor at Loyola Marymount University and a postdoctoral fellow in the humanities at Stanford University. He graduated with his PhD from the New School in 2005, where he wrote his dissertation on Aristotle. And his scholarship focuses on Aristotle, and particularly the history of Aristotelian interpretation in the Western and Islamic traditions, and the philosophy of Martin Heidegger. His recent publications include Being Affected, The Pathos of Truth in Interpreting Heidegger, Critical Essays from Cambridge University Press. He has also written recently Deconstructing Dasein, Heidegger's Earliest Interpretations of Aristotle's De Anima, which was published in the Review of Metaphysics in December 2007, and Heidegger, Aristotle, and Animal Life, which was published in Philosophy Today in 2007. So Josh joins me today on the Digital Dialogue to discuss his essay, Being Ensouled, The Role of Desire as an Efficient Cause in Aristotle's De Anima. So it's a great pleasure to welcome you, Josh, to the Digital Dialogue.
Thank you, Chris. It's a pleasure to once again have a conversation with you.
Yeah, well, we've had, first of all, we are share the same graduate school in terms of where we graduated, so there's always a good source of talk about the New School and what it means to have graduated from the New School. But, you know, over the course of time with seeing you at SPEP and at the Ancient Philosophy Society, I've really enjoyed our conversation. So it's great to have you here on the Digital Dialogue to record something and to talk about two of our loves, Heidegger and Aristotle.
Yes. As Heidegger would say, when he was teaching Aristotle, he would teach Aristotle very early in the morning, obviously, in Freiburg. It was dubbed the Aristotle Breakfast Club. So
right, and we should note that I'm on the East Coast. It's not quite as early, but you're on the West Coast, and it is very early in the morning. So that's good. We are philosophizing early. And, of course, Heidegger also recommended 10 years of study of Aristotle before you began philosophy. So I'm hoping that I'm getting ready now to begin my study of philosophy.
We're still working along that road.
Exactly. So talk to me a little bit about this essay, Being Ensouled and the Role of Desire as an Efficient Cause in the De Anima.
Well, I'm really interested in questioning a common paradigm in research and commentary devoted to Aristotle, and that specifically concerns how we conceive of substance. And as I argue in the paper, substance is often understood in static terms, both descriptively and causally. I think we can speak about how substance is understood descriptively when we just speak about the word substance in the Latin, which is, you know, substantia, right, which literally refers to that which stands under something else. And so I think the major problem with how we understand substance is that it exists as something that remains intrinsically unchanged, something that's static, something that's passive. And it enjoys a kind of separation or independence of existence from its accidental qualities. Mm-hmm. So I'm really attempting in this paper to question sort of the static description of substance, and also question how we conceive of substance causally. Mm-hmm. I think so much emphasis has been placed upon an understanding of substance as a kind of formal cause, and I think that's rightfully understood. But the problem with the formal cause is that, once again, when we consider the formal cause, we consider the form as that which is in a certain sense acting upon the matter, and simply responsible for the persistence of sort of maintaining its own activity upon the matter. And so what I'm trying to do in this paper is to really maybe try to reconfigure our understanding of substance so it can be understood and dynamically.
Mm-hmm.
This is a point that I try to develop with relationship not to understanding the formal cause of substance as much as how it functions as a kind of efficient cause.
Right. Well, maybe we could start and think a little bit about that first
Sure.
point you made about the, you know, static versus dynamic. That's something that I've been working a lot on myself, is trying to uncover that a caricature, really, of Aristotle as having a static conception of substance. And I think you're right to point in some ways to the translation. In a good Heideggerian move, you know, blame
yes.
certain things on translations.
But, we can always blame it on translation.
Right. But I think, you know, one of the things I'm interested in what may have driven the tradition to really try to take on a more static conception of substance. And I think you were hitting on it a little bit, you know, this notion
yeah.
that we could find some firm foundation and that upon which we could upon which we could sort of rely and build a whole edifice of system. I mean, obviously at this point you kind of think of the architectural metaphors of Descartes
yeah.
The thing that I think is interesting and important is that, you know, that desire for stability or for a certain kind of certainty, even if you cash it out in terms of epistemological interests,
yes.
you know, that led to the use of, you know, in modern period, the appeal to substance as that which doesn't have a cause and the sort of this ultimate principle of organization and unity. So that's the kind of history that you have to struggle with as you try to rethink Aristotle in more dynamic ways.
Yes, and I also think that we can also attribute the misunderstanding to when we speak about what essence is,
mm.
right? The Greek participle einai, we mm-hmm. commonly translate as existing as what always is.
Right.
So I think there's that same problem in terms of how we understand the temporal dimension of essence.
Yeah. Well, one of the things, you know, I did done significant work. I mean, Aristotle is one of Aristotle's most beautiful and strange phrases is this tauti en einai, which gets translated
yes.
as essence, yeah. but which could be translated as the what it was for something to be what it
yes.
is. And you know, and that has, and I've tried to also articulate this in various places, that has a temporal dimension that is not the kind of same structure that we might think of in terms of permanence.
Yes.
But I also wonder, just as a way of thinking a little bit more about the temporal, because, and your paper gets at this a little bit too at the end, particularly when you talk about Eros and about the way Aristotle conceptualizes the divine at the end and the relation of desire to that. You know, there's a sense in which even the eternal for Aristotle is dynamic, is not as static as I think a caricature of the of eternity is.
Yeah.
And I have myself been often caught up with a concern to undermine this appeal to permanence and eternity. But there is a sense in which for Aristotle, this ongoing process, this ongoing activity of nature itself is it's eternal, but it's not static in the way that we would think about it.
Yeah.
I don't know what you think about that or how do you want to, I mean, do you want to say, okay, static, appeal to eternity, all those things are sort of the same bad kind?
Well, what I'm ultimately, I'm concerned. I'm trying to establish a kind of new paradigm for rethinking ousia in Aristotle, and I'm trying to move away from this traditionally how we understand anargia as a kind of being at work, or even entelecheia as a kind of being at work, staying itself, to a paradigm that really privileges the role of kinesis, specifically how we understand movement throughout Aristotle's writings. I think that there's a temporal dimension to movement that one can contrast with Aristotle's account of activity in the sense of entelecheia.
Yeah. So this is something that actually maybe we should try and talk a little bit more about. I mean, I think I did a digital dialogue with Frank Gonzalez a few weeks ago or a few months ago, and he was pressing this line a little bit too. Obviously for both of you, I think it comes out of a deep engagement with Heidegger and Heidegger's recognition that kinesis is critical to understanding what Aristotle's doing. But I would want to ask you and talk a little bit more about the relationship between kinesis and ergeia. If we take those passages in Metaphysics Book 9, 6 through 8, where Aristotle really is attempting to delineate the difference between a praxis or an ergeia as praxis and kinesis. And the issue is sort of what's the relationship to the end in these different kinds of activities. And a kinesis is one that does not have its end in itself. And an ergeia or praxis is a complete action that does have its end in itself. And so now those passages seem in tension with some of the things he says in the physics, where kinesis is perhaps less understood in a slightly different way. So I don't know what you think about that distinction. And is it that you want to privilege kinesis in the sense of being this sort of ontological ground of an ergeia in a way that would reverse the way at least Aristotle seems to talk about it?
Yeah, I'm attempting to reverse that line of thinking by returning to maybe one of Aristotle's earliest philosophical works, known as the Protrepticus, mm-hmm. where he does not seem to strictly distinguish between kinesis on the one hand and energeia or entelecheia on the other. Mm-hmm. I think you could even argue that he privileges the role of kinesis in such a sense that kinesis is understood to occupy this temporal dimension that I think is not as that does not become so evident obviously when we read the later mm-hmm. Books of the Metaphysics.
So what is the what sort of temporality is that? Let's say the temporality of kinesis in the Protrepticus.
Well, he speaks about temporality as it's understood in terms of how one activity that one engages in is he says that when a man is asleep, a man is said to live when he becomes capable of passing over into that movement in virtue of which we say that that the man is waking and perceiving something. Mm-hmm. So what I'm emphasizing here is we have to understand kinesis in terms of these kinds of activities that we engage in that involve some kind of a process, some kind of a passage of from one stage of being to another stage of being. Mm-hmm. And these have to be understood as perhaps as a matter of degrees, right? As opposed to how we might strictly understand energeia, right? As having no end, right, as being a kind of end in itself. So I'm interested perhaps in developing an understanding of energeia once again as a kind of continual process.
So that
lends itself to understanding the role of living beings, right, as engaging in these kinds of processes occurring throughout time.
Well, good. I mean, I guess what I want to ask about more then is, what is it that kinesis gives you that, let me just put it this way, energeia properly understood wouldn't give you? I mean, I do agree that, you know, if we understand energeia in a certain way and as opposed to and different from dunamis and perhaps not even having dunamis in it at all, then we do run into some issues. And Aristotle does speak in those terms in the Metaphysics Book 12, you know, where he's talking about God. It seems to me that we could, energeia properly understood as bound up intimately with dunamis is a good model under which to understand the activities of living being. And I think in the De Anima, this is exactly the model that Aristotle operates on.
Yeah.
I think I'm interested in and sensitive to what I think might be your agenda with retrieving kinesis. And I like what you did with the Percepticus in this essay. It's really nice to see the development of this difference between kinesis and energeia. So maybe you could talk a little bit, and I kind of had the same question with Heidegger. Why is he so interested in retrieving kinesis as opposed to rethinking the meaning of energeia in a more dynamic and, I think, interesting way?
Well, once again, I think kinesis, if we understand it as a kind of movement, speaks to how we find ourselves in the world. Mm-hmm. Again, I'm not merely speaking here about human being, but I also would like to extend this to how we think, as Aristotle thinks, about living beings.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, once again, when Aristotle speaks about what living is, I think Heidegger would probably agree with this, that life is a kind of movement, right? It's a kind of, one might say, it's a kind of incomplete movement, a movement that, in a certain sense, has its end outside of itself.
Mm-hmm.
And if we understand movement as a kind of, incomplete activity, and energeia telos, as Aristotle says, it enables one to literally become affected by the world in terms of how one encounters the world. So I think we need movement as a ground for affectivity in terms of how we come to experience the world. So this is what I'm emphasizing in terms of why we should return to the De Anima.
Mm-hmm. But okay, so let's all right. So there's two issues. One, okay, let's do that now in a minute, because I think, I mean, and also in my my Aristotle book on truth, I did a lot of work in this on the De Anima. Is included the De Anima is included in that book quite a bit, a reading of it, and so I think our concerns are very similar in how we are looking at the De Anima, although I think we may come down slightly differently in terms of the role of kinesis. But in any case, I just want to see if I understand what you're saying here about why retrieve kinesis. So there is something, on your view, therefore, that is positive about the externality of the end in a kinesis. That is to say that So long as kinesis is being, this is a great, a formulation that Ari Kosman has used, which is that a kinesis,
the suicide
mission, right? Is kinesis, yeah. As long as it's existent, it is, it can't die. But as soon as it reaches its end, it dies. So in that sense, yes, I think there is, as he calls it, this auto-subversive nature of kinesis. As soon as it completes itself, it dissolves. So yeah. I think that's true with regard to, let's say, living being, right? Of course, we take a certain conception of death as an end. But of course, obviously, we can have different understandings of the for the sake of which in Aristotle I think there's certainly passages in Aristotle where I think in the Physics where he talks about, well, there's two senses of end. One is that sort of that has this idea of a goal that's outside of the activity itself, and then there's another sense of a purposefulness activity. I mean, Hegel also obviously emphasizes that. So I do appreciate the issue of, and as you were articulating, I appreciate the issue of finitude and the finite nature of kinesis as giving us something that perhaps the conception of energeia doesn't. But I do think we should talk a little bit more about the notion of life and our encounters with things, because on my reading, and I think it's not that different from what you articulate in the paper, although I'd be interested to hear, there is a cooperation between the powers of the soul and the nature of things that are encountered by the soul. So that, for example, when we see something, we can see it precisely because it gives itself, these things give themselves to be seen, right?
Yes.
And so, but that encounter is something that is a joint activity. And I think actually the model should be something like an energeia that is actualized in these moments of encounter. So, how do you want to think about kinesis in those contexts?
Well, I'm concerned about once again what the paradigm is for how the soul. You said there's a kind of joint cooperation.
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, that language to me might privilege, and maybe I'm misinterpreting you, a kind of correspondence between the soul and the things that the soul encounters in the world. And I guess I'm concerned about whether or not that lends itself to some kind of a correspondence theory of truth, right? And we come back to the same problem about how do we establish, there seems to be some adequation between the soul and the thing.
Right.
So I think the kinetic model, at least along the lines as has been developed and pressed by Heidegger, right, is attempting to disclose another understanding of what the relationship between the soul and things that the soul encounters in the world are, in the sense of, the movement itself, I think, is meant to disclose. It's a way of disclosing things.
Mm.
Maybe if you could speak a little bit more about that, that cooperation.
Sure.
So
yeah, no, I appreciate the point. I mean, so part of this is this peculiar combination that I've somehow taken on, particularly since my move here to Penn State, which I think is a rich one, but is also not often combined. Namely, this tradition of American naturalism and Heideggerian phenomenology. So
yeah,
the vocabulary of cooperation is really drawn from of philosophers like Frederick Woodbridge, who's an American naturalist who had influence on John Herman Randall and on John Dewey. And Woodbridge is in his book Aristotle's Vision of Nature, which is long out of print and probably very difficult to get your hands on.
No, I've read it passingly.
Yeah, he has this great line, and it's sort of the idea around which his engagement with Aristotle is focused. And he says there's a correlation between the powers of the soul and the natural conditions of their exercise.
Yeah.
And part of what I want to emphasize is with the vocabulary of cooperation, which is also drawn from Woodbridge. He uses it in his essay on nature and other things. Is this notion that we are working together with the things of nature when we do things like perceive them? I mean, even on the very basic level of perception. And so. Yeah. Now, when you bring up the question of correspondence, I took the strategy, at least in the Aristotle book on truth, to embrace that, but totally reconceptualize it in the sense of I want to think of not of correspondence, but co-responsibility, the ability to respond together with things. And that's something that would then root everything in a certain kind of hexis, and I think along the lines that you're trying to articulate in this paper in terms of, perceiving is an ability. It is something that we have and we also cultivate. And it is, and the fact that we can see things, that we can hear things, that things strike us in certain kinds of ways, is because we human beings are also natural beings, and therefore it makes perfect sense that nature would be encounterable for us.
Yes,
and that's something that I think Aristotle was clearly aware of, and also. Continued to be struck by. And I think I heard a lot of sort of that in your paper, the recognition that we, and to put it in my terms, that we belong to nature in such a way that we can respond to things. We have the ability to respond together with things. But what that involves then is that not only are we actively engaged, but the things are actively engaged, and not only are we passively struck by things, but things are passively struck by us. So I really tried to articulate it in a middle voiced activity.
Yes, yeah, so, I think that's essential to retain the middle voiced sort of dynamic, specifically when we speak about an activity like perception, which involves, obviously, as you said, the unity of the passive and the active.
Right, and you do a great job, I think, in this essay with bringing together the poiein and poskein and really emphasizing that aspect, although I don't know that you had used the vocabulary of middle voice in this essay, but you're working with it, the active and the passive belonging together, right?
Yeah, that's I think that's critical for, once again, understanding the role of desire, obviously, in the De Anima. When Aristotle speaks about the role of desire as the capacity that moves while being itself moved.
Right.
So once again, that's one way of rethinking, the importance of this unity of passivity and activity.
Right. And I mean, even you look at the first line of the Metaphysics, where all human beings are regatai, desire in this middle voice.
Yes.
No, right?
Very,
Adonai.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is a perfect moment of where exactly what is meant is articulated in this in the middle voice and capture that. So maybe you could talk a little bit more about the role of desire in as you see it in this paper. Particularly, you have some nice formulations, I think, about the relationship between logos and desire, and actually maybe this question has more to do with logos in relationship to desire, in relationship to aesthesis, and even in relationship to eros, as you articulate in the paper. I think you did a nice job of of uncovering a really deep and rich understanding of logos.
Yeah. Well, I am very much interested in the relationship between desire and logos, I'm really attempting to in a certain sense privilege the role of desire in, as a dunamis, mm-hmm. Within the soul for Aristotle, specifically because if we understand desire very generally as a kind of movement of striving. This is something that I also. This is a term that I emphasize yeah. throughout the paper. I think it enriches, right, our understanding of entelecheia. Yeah. If we understand entelecheia as a kind of being at work, whereby how the soul, in a certain sense, strives to maintain. And preserve itself. Mm-hmm. There seems to, in this sense, desire functions as a kind of efficient cause, which is responsible for once again interacting with some of the other capacities of the soul, like logos and aisthesis, for instance.
Right.
Without desire, right? I would argue that. Substance, the way that Aristotle understands substance as entelecheia, mm-hmm. it lacks a certain kind of teleological unity.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the line that I'm really trying to develop throughout the paper. What privileging desire in relationship to these other capacities like aisthesis, perception, and logos, for mm-hmm. instance.
So, what is? I mean, I'm thinking a little bit about some of the things Aristotle. Whenever you talk about desire, of course, my mind also goes to those chapters in Book 12 of the Metaphysics,
yeah.
where he talks about, and then of course, ultimately he. Articulates the being of God in terms of eromenos, in terms of eros, which
yeah.
I think, is obviously along the same lines of what, one could understand eros as a very rich and robust understanding of desire.
Yes.
And so that I think we're on the same page about that. But I do wonder what's at stake with calling it an efficient cause rather than a final cause. I mean, one of the things that Aristotle seems to want to talk reasons, one of the reasons why Aristotle seems to want to identify Eros with the divine is
yep.
that it is one of the few examples of a kind of motion that, or a relationship that is not reciprocal, right? That something can be desired, but not be in motion, right? In the sense that seems to be part of what he wants to appeal to when he appeals to God in that context. I mean, it's a complicated issue and a complicated question, but so maybe you could talk a little bit more about how you want to understand desire. Let's just say desire as an efficient cause. So this isn't any longer an efficient cause in the modern sense of something that's pushing and mechanistically, obviously.
No, not at all. I think that really, in the most robust sense, the efficient cause is a kind of, as Aristotle says, it's a kind of principle. It's a kind of arche. Mm-hmm. But again, we have to understand this arche dynamically, from which movement. Proceeds. Mm. So it's important I think that when Aristotle speaks about the efficient cause, that this is we can't distinguish in any way sort of the role of movement, right? From the efficient cause itself. And I think desire, as Aristotle says, if desire is understood as a kind of is responsible for the movement of the soul, as he says, right? Mm-hmm. It brings the soul to movement, right? That's in a certain sense we can retain. As you said, I'm trying to move away from a modern understanding of efficient cause to if it's the origin that is from whence the movement comes, then that origin is really dynamic in nature.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something that can understood in any static sense.
Right. The version of the paper that you sent to me on page 6, you quote you quote from the De Motu Animalium, and you talk about the desire, that desire is both active and passive, and the quote you put there is from Aristotle's, the process is simultaneous and quick because the active, the poetikon, and the passive, the pathetikon, are by nature closely interrelated, and that's at 702 A16 through 21.
Yeah.
So that gets at this whole idea of the kind of middle voiced activity that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah, and I think we can capture Aristotle's notion of the efficient cause by this kind of middle voiced activity.
Mm-hmm. So
if you disagree with that or not? I mean,
no, I think that's. I mean, I'm, you know, I guess I. You know, the idea of trying to rehabilitate or our understanding of efficient cause is a good one. I share your concern that it gets taken up in this sort of very mechanistic way in the history in the tradition. Of course, we always have to be careful about qualifying ourselves to say, you know, certain elements of the tradition, right? Because there's always. You know, there's always also good readings that happen out there. But I do wonder about what happens to the difference between the efficient and final cause. Although maybe this isn't really that important, because as Aristotle himself says in the Physics, Book 2 of the Physics, that. Really, the formal, final, and efficient cause are all kind of the same, and it's really the difference between the material cause, and then you have an important discussion to have about how we don't understand the material and formal causes or matter and form as disjointed in Aristotle either. So that's a sort of another level of. Yeah, go ahead.
In a certain sense, with the causes, we can understand sort of desire as operating all the way down. I mean, my favorite example from the Physics is when Aristotle speaks about, as you know, matter. You know, matter also possesses a kind of desire, right? And that metaphorically understood, to strive towards form. just as form strives towards matter. So there seems to be a kind of reciprocity, some kind of, as you said earlier, a kind of
cooperation.
You know,
operation. Yeah.
Or, co-responsiveness.
Co-responsiveness, right. I think that's right. And I do like the fact that, obviously in Aristotle and also in all of Greek thinking, I guess we could say, the registers in which desire can play is really quite powerful. I mean, you know, you have it in things like epithumia and the thumos, which is this just kind of uncontrollable desire that overcomes one and overtakes one and doesn't necessarily have much relationship to anything, you know, thoughtful or noetic or even logical. And then there is, you know, there's more, let's say, things like boulesis and others have this wanting, which might have more relationship to logos and nous, and then you have eros, which can have all kinds of different resonances, which it can be both the most uncontrolled and the most dangerous, as well as the most bound up with the nature of things and divine.
Yeah, yeah. You know? So it has to be understood in all those registers.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So I think that those are, I think those are really important points. So on your reading, it's really desire that's at the root of all this, and you sort of read Logos through desire, is that right?
Yes, I do. I read Logos as, you know, and I think, you know, that obviously if we turn to the Nicomachean Ethics, Aristotle speaks about this relationship between logos and desire, specifically when he speaks about what it means to be a human being.
Right.
I'm thinking primarily of the role of proeuresis,
right?
Where he says that, how do we understand what the principle of proeuresis is, or the principle of, one might translate proeuresis here as intention, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he says that intention is either a desiring intellect or a kind of intellecting desire.
Right.
So once again, we have this very sort of, we have to question what the relationship is between, he's speaking here of dianoia here.
Right.
But we really have to question what precisely the relationship is between, you know, the capacity of nous, the capacity of dianoia, and the capacity of desire.
I think you're referring to this. Had this passage in front of me recently. Is this Nicomachean Ethics 6.2?
Yeah, 6.2. That's the passage.
11:39 B4 and 5, where it says,
so
choice is either desiderative thought or thoughtful desire. It's either orektikos nous or.
Orexis
dianoia.
Dianoia.
Yeah, exactly.
So the question is, there seems to remain a kind of ambiguity, right, between these. Do you understand this as an ambiguity, or do you understand it as some, as you said earlier, there seems to be a cooperation or sort of responsiveness.
I think, one of the things I've been... In my reading of the American naturalist like Woodbridge, and even somebody like a thinker like John Smith, who has some essays, is also a pragmatist, who has some essays about this whole question of cooperation and the relationship between, let's say, being and language in particular.
Yeah.
And one of the things that John Smith says, and I'm convinced by it, is that, look, you know, those who say that language is, overlays reality and perverts it in a way, it's really the onus is on them to show that. Whereas it seems much more feasible to begin with the recognition that language does get at the nature of things. Now, it doesn't get at the nature of things in their entirety, and there are limits, but it is, so that's why this emphasis on cooperation is critical from my perspective, co-responsibility, because we all, in all of our relationships with everything, in our encounters with everything, from the from the deepest kind of connections of, interhuman relationships to just the ability to perceive the blue on the cup that I'm looking at, for example, is, those all depend upon an ability to work together between our soul and nature. And I think what you have here with regard to choice and desiderative thought and thoughtful desire is, we have over the course of time had a tendency to fall in love with our distinctions. We make distinctions and then we reify those distinctions.
Yes.
And so that's what's happening, I think, with this question of, the language in Aristotle there is beautiful. He's perfectly happy privileging one over the other and then reversing it, if we can think of it that way.
It also occurs once again in Metaphysics 9.2 when he distinguishes between rational capacities and non-rational capacities. He emphasizes when he speaks about rational capacities, right, that there is something else besides reason that is, something else besides logos that has to be taken into account, specifically the role of desire.
Right.
So again, there's another example where there seems to be this mutual you know, as you said earlier, this response, responsibility.
Yeah. So, and I mean, I think, and that actually gets to one of the main points of my my book on Aristotle, which is that the methodological approach I try to take in that text is what I'm calling a legomenology, which is sort of the recognition that, and Aristotle does this all the time, that the way we say things lends insight into the way things are in a certain way. So by attending to formulations like the ones we've been attending to, something is voiced there, and something is voiced about the belonging together of desire and nous and the belonging together of logos and desire. So that comes to language. Now, language can't capture it in it all its complete totality, but it does come to language.
Yeah, and something else that I think should be emphasized here is that to understand this unity between desire and logos is to understand, once again, how when we speak about logos, logos has a way of you know, as Aristotle says, choosing between contraries, right? And what I try to argue in the paper, at least, is that one can understand desire, right, as also, in a certain sense, having this ability to pursue, you know, one contrary and avoid another.
Mm-hmm.
There seems to be already within the role of desire this sort of this awareness. Maybe one might call it a kind of quasi or meta awareness. I'm not sure what to call it, but some kind of an awareness of contraries,
right?
And this is something that Aristotle obviously speaks about extensively when he speaks about the role of logos.
Right.
So again, it only raises the question about what this relationship really is.
Right. No, that makes sense. So where are you going from here? What are you working on now? And is this essay sort of the basis of something bigger?
This essay is really the basis of a larger project for me, which I call Being in Life.
Mm-hmm.
And really
small
trying
topics there.
Small topic, right? Really trying to once again question what the relationship is between usia on the one hand and when we speak about Zoe on the other. How can we bring together these two themes in Aristotle? Mm-hmm. And as you said earlier, maybe try to rethink them in terms of their mutual responsibility that they have towards each other. I mean, I think so much of Aristotle, particularly, is I think, at least in terms of the history of the tradition, has focused upon his ontology, I'm interested, you know, in going back to, Aristotle, one might say as a zoologist, right? You know, there's that famous picture, I think, of Aristotle, you know, studying animals,
right?
So I think that's and I think there are implications for this, because if we think about Aristotle as a biologist, right?
Mm-hmm.
Before he really took up these metaphysical questions, so maybe biology is a kind of key to understanding Aristotle's metaphysics.
Yeah. Well, you begin your essay here with that great quote from Ackerl about Gerald Chernus. I'll just read it as
sure.
Ackerl. It says, I recall Ackerl saying, I recall that in 1951, Harold Chernus told me that Aristotle's biology was the key to his metaphysics. Unfortunately, I did not have the wit to interpret this Delphic utterance.
Yeah.
So, but I think you're right. And I do think that, that Aristotle's engagement with life is the key to understanding his whole way of thinking and his habits of thinking. So well, when you as you continue to work on that that larger project, Being in Life, I hope you will come again onto the Digital Dialogue, Josh. I really appreciate you being here.
Yes.
And joining me, even though it's been it's early in the morning there for you, so
no, it was a pleasure in the sense of anargia, the sense of this kind of complete activity that is an end in itself, one might say.
thank you, that's great. So this has been the Digital Dialogue.
The Digital Dialogue is produced under a Creative Commons non-commercial share-alike license. To download or subscribe to The Digital Dialogue, visit iTunes U at the Apple iTunes Store and search on Digital Dialogue. You will find it under the Pennsylvania State University area of the iTunes Store. You may also visit my website, The Long Road, at www.personal.psu.edu/cpl2. Or you can join us on Facebook by becoming a fan of The Digital Dialogue on our Facebook page. Just search Facebook for The Digital Dialogue. This has been The Digital Dialogue.